You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Tony Del Plato. Tony, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So the way we start the show is, who are you? What do we need to start this conversation?
I'm not sure age is the best place to start, but I just turned 68, and I have to say, it's in some ways I'm surprised I made it this far, and in so many other ways I'm glad about where I am. And I think about it's been a long and winding road for me, up and down, and I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, lived for a little while in Staten Island, and have been up in the Finger Lakes for about 41 plus years. Lived for about 2 years in Buffalo, but this has been my home for most of my adult life.
So, and you're also, you're very active in sustainability.
Well, it's part of my part of how I want to operate, and I've been conservative and in how I use the things in my life, try not to waste, and certainly the idea of sustainability. It's hard to argue whether it's progressive or conservative, but the idea of leaving the future at least in as good a shape as it's in now, which is not in very good shape, but certainly to improve it, but not to diminish the quality of the planet we live on for the future.
You brought some music with you. What should we start the show with?
I guess I'm thinking of the Last Poet song, "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised."
Sure.
Whether you got The Last Poet or Gil Scott-Heron.
I was having a hard time finding the other one.
I've got the LP, and like a lot of my stuff, it's stashed away. My John Trudell cassette tape. So, probably stashed away in the same place that my Last Poet's album
is
stashed.
This is the Gil Scott-Heron version of "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised."
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Mendel Rivers to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner. The revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on reports from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lifes of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he had been saving for just the right occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so goddamn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally screwed Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news, and no pictures of Harry Arm women liberationists and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, or Engelbert Humperdinck. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised. Will not be televised. Not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Tony Del Plato. The revolution will not be televised.
Well, you know, I think one reason why I chose this is that I think the last poets, and only probably later in Gil Scott-Heron's life, they could not have anticipated how just about everything in our lives now can be televised. I think... you know, the last poets probably couldn't imagine having telephones that were cameras, video cameras, and while things are happening, shooting them live. And of course, what we're seeing all over the country, probably all over the world, really, but all over the country, with made plain and clear the attacks on black men, mm-hmm. and how mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter is certainly not a hate group, which I argue with my cousin, who considers them a hate group, but I try to explain that you know, it's not a hate group. It's the anger and pain that they're expressing over watching husbands, wives, husband. Well, I guess in some cases women, but mostly husbands, brothers, cousins, friends,
sons
shot down unarmed.
Yeah,
it's how can you not express outrage? I mean, you know, of course, a lot of the black athletes are stepping up. We're the white athletes, mm-hmm. you know, stepping up to say, you know, Black Lives Matter. And I was in Rochester at the Red Wings ball game Friday night, and a guy was running across the parking lot. He was pretty drunk, and he was yelling, "All lives matter! All lives matter!" And he was an African American man, and I said, "Black lives matter," and he looked at me kind of startled. And I think it's important for white people not to get so touchy and defensive, and not fully appreciate the fact that Black Lives Matter is because black lives are getting shot down
right.
In cold blood.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean that white doesn't matter, yellow, brown, red.
And what's interesting in this particular time zone is there's a black economist at Harvard who has just run numbers on 6 different police departments and their use of lethal force. And all of their use of force up to the point of lethal force is disproportionate against persons of color.
Mm-hmm.
But lethal force is proportional, which was shocked me when I heard those. But he wanted to get data, so everything that leads up to that is unfairly inflicted by race, and yet we don't. And so you can see where people have different perceptions and start messing with each other. I want to come back to you. What experience or experiences have helped to shape, you know, who you are? What are the relevant ones now to where you are at 68?
Well, you know, at 68, I'd have to say quite a few.
Yeah.
But I think from the beginning of my early life, I had at least the first 10 years of my life a great childhood in Brooklyn, New York, dozens of kids in the streets all the time, the schoolyards, and you know, and all the places we played and hung out.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, though, I think really my hearing loss, my father's abuse of my mother, my being a cook and a partner at Moosewood Restaurant, you know, I would say, you know, those are the context
mm-hmm, sure.
in which I grew up and continue to try to grow. I'm still trying to grow up in so many ways.
So how did they shape you?
Well, my hearing loss didn't get acknowledged until high school, when I began to realize, wow, I did have a problem. My father kind of denied it. In elementary school, I was put into a class for not permanently, but just mm-hmm. periodically to learn lip reading and sign language. So that was it was pretty upsetting. I was fifth or sixth grade. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so we're probably looking at 10, 11. And so I went home and said, Dad, they put me in a kid in a class with deaf kids. I said, deaf kid? What are they putting you in a class with deaf kids for? Well, like the teacher thought I had a hearing problem. And my father said, you having any trouble hearing me? And I said, no, you don't have a hearing problem. And so that's how my father dealt with it. My mother was an Italian immigrant. Her English constantly improved, as of course, as she lived here from 1947 on. My parents, World War II sweethearts in southern Italy. And anyway, so my mom didn't speak English and had a hard time advocating. And my father just ignored it. And then by the time I got to college, I had some hearing tests, and I was actually rejected from the draft because of
your hearing issues.
My hearing.
Right.
And
so how did you manage your hearing?
Well, yeah, sometimes I bluff my way through. I mean, often I thought I heard what somebody said when in fact they didn't say anything.
Like what you thought you heard.
What I thought I heard, exactly. And so, and I began to learn how to read faces in mm-hmm. a way that, you know, if I see a puzzled look on somebody's face, I'll check back with them.
Right.
But more often than not, you know, I would say, you know, it was, I responded. Sometimes people would in some way either question me back or we'd move on. And at this point, of course, in my life, I realized a lot of people probably in those days would walk away thinking, wow, is Tony retarded or did he misunderstand? So, I mean, you know, it's one of those things that it took a while before, I guess, being somewhat of a pain by saying, excuse me, I didn't hear what you said.
Right.
I hate to say that too often. Now, I've had hearing aids now, right. which help tremendously. Mm-hmm. I have a high-frequency hearing loss. So at any rate, you know, the hearing is one of those things that kind of dogged me through most of my life.
Right. So when were you old enough to be able to say, "Oh, I may not have heard you accurately"? When were you mature enough? Because a lot of young guys have the bluster and they don't want to go there.
No.
When were you able to do that?
Boy, it's hard to say. I'm gonna guesstimate. You know, maybe my 30s.
Yeah. You spent a lot of life without being able to kind of own up to that.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, you know, missing a lot.
Yeah.
You know, really missing a lot, misunderstanding a lot. Frustration, mm-hmm. anger would mm-hmm. often come like, shit, I thought I heard you, you know, what you said. And
right. But I didn't.
But I didn't. Yeah, and yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, I think that you know, what the cause of it, it's hard to tell. It's apparently it's in my... in the audio nerve, and so, you know, whether it's because I dove out of a crib, you know, as an infant and landed on my head, or whether it's eating lead paint or right. whatever might have caused the neurological damage. It's I adapted sometimes well, sometimes mm-hmm. not. But now, I mean, definitely, I'm, you know, my hearing's at a point where, you know, I'm not isolated socially. Right. You know, I mean, I engage people and my close friends, of course, and family. You know, they're certainly understanding. And
how did your relationships with them change once you became more clear about your need to take action?
Well, you know, it's hard to say when.
But how? Not so I much think, when, but how did they change? What was the quality? I assume that they changed.
Well, I suppose. Yeah, I mean. Chances are the less defensive I became and the more open to really listening to somebody and wanting to know what they have to say, you know, I think that, you know, definitely went through changes with my brother in a way that, you know, we were my youngest brother, I'm the oldest. He dropped out of high school. I first graduate from college and, you know, those kind of sibling tensions. But
right.
as we got older, I mean, my brother's one of my closest friends next to my partner, Gina, and my old buddy from grade school, Jerry, who has a hearing problem also. So we commiserate a lot.
So what brought you to Ithaca?
the revolution wasn't happening in New York City or Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
I was a student. So I went to grad school and dropped out. I went to the City University of New York, a variety of campuses, and I lived in Staten Island. We went to a school named Richmond College, which mm-hmm. was a senior college, experimental, a lot of faculty, very radical thinkers, both of the right and the left, you know, a lot of anarchists and socialists and communist thinking, as well as Ayn Rand types mm-hmm. of advocates. And so that college, you know, was just a springboard to Ithaca. Many of the people I met there and in other parts of New York, eventually we migrated to Ithaca.
Huh.
You know, we were starting alternative schools, back to the land.
Right, right.
Certainly not a whole lot different than the, you know, the people who are survivalist, except that our vision was full of peace and love.
Right. And less...
And, you know, less like, you know, guarding yourself from the world.
And
visited from roughly 72, 73 until I moved up in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And, I guess what... You know, Cornell brought a lot, Ithaca College and the general environs. And once I dropped out of grad school, I was a psychology major, and I was in a bicycle accident. I was on the bike and no helmet, and fortunately survived with just a severe concussion and possible mild fracture, but they never really found a fracture. And... you know, I thought, man, life in New York is hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally and figuratively.
Right, right, right.
And so, it was time to consider elsewhere. And so anyway, a lot of folks were coming up into this area with all sorts of social and political experiments. I wanted to be part of that flow.
Right, right. So what did you join up with when you got here?
Well, I was already involved with about... Well, I'd say probably close to 100 people, and we formed a variety of different communes and collectives around. And some weren't affiliated necessarily with any collective or group. It was mm-hmm, just mm-hmm. individuals who came up.
Sure.
There was the Blue Air Herald School. It was one of the projects back in the 70s that was evolving out in Danby. Then there's a number of gay collectives, the Lavender Hill Group out in West Danby. And then there was the Moosewood Group, and there was Cabbage Town Cafe before mm-hmm. Julie Jordan bought it and made it more famous. When I moved up in 1975, Cabbage Town was just starting. It was a collectively owned and mm-hmm. managed business, and Moosewood was just, you know, I had heard about it and mm-hmm. eventually saw, you know, the cookbook that Molly Katz and had authored, and that was kind of how it all began.
Mm-hmm. How did you find a life here?
Well, you know, when I first moved up, I moved into a commune with 17 people. It was 13 adults and 4 children. It was the Elm Street commune. It was the last political, from what I understand, the last political commune in Ithaca. And lived there for probably less than a year. And then pretty much everybody moved out. The house was sold, but made some really good friends. My mom was stunned. My brothers and friends from New York couldn't believe, how can you live with 17 people? You
know,
that's a lot of toilet sharing and, the kitchen. I mean, you know, we're talking about, where things happen. And it kind of worked fine. I mean, I'd been involved in co-ops and communes in Staten Island through my college years, and lived with groups of people, even if we didn't call ourselves a commune. Yeah.
Yeah. Neat. Let's cut to music. What should we play next? I've got the Cream, I'm So Glad, or Aretha Franklin, or...
Let's save Aretha for the end.
For the end,
and
sure.
Let's... I'm so glad. I am glad that I'm here.
Good.
I'm so glad
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Tony Del Plato. So, Tony, how have you changed over the years? What has life brought your way that you didn't anticipate?
A fair amount of satisfaction and happiness and stability in my life right now is something that I couldn't imagine when I first moved out of my parents' house at 19 and then began my life on my own.
In times that were pretty heady and political.
Yeah, heady and political. And, you know, it's, I mean, when I think about especially the women in my life, I mean, it wasn't just a matter of me being a man trying to be aware of, you know, sexism and what was the right thing to do. The women in my life demanded it, both in my relationships and, of course, working with a collective, former collective and group as large as Moosewood ownership. 13 women and 4 or 5 men at most. And and then, of course, my friends and all of whom, you know, the values of feminism were an important part of our daily life. And we created struggle, as you can imagine. Often difficulties, and after college and then moving up here, the Finger Lakes and has a amazing transformative air. It's you know, the best way I can think about it, in the sense that in my late 20s, I probably went through the hardest time in my life politically. You know, it was like the revolution not only wasn't being televised, but it seemed like it just wasn't happening. And so that that became difficult. And I remember the West Valley radioactive waste struggle down in West Valley in New York, south of Buffalo. And we were losing that struggle. And my relationship here had broken up. And so I think a number of things kind of converged in my late 20s, 30, that led to what most people consider a nervous breakdown and, total total loss of a desire to live, and yet again, family and friends came to the rescue in many ways, as well as seeking the strength that I could within myself. Came out of that period, just life started to stabilize. Met a wonderful woman who became the mother of my son. We split up after 19 years and together, and we're still good friends and partners at Moosewood, and we're still our son's parents, and we have a decent relationship in that way. And so, it's when I think about the lowest parts of my life, whether it's just being out of a job at that time. Also, I mean, it was just like, there was just things were terrible. Figured out a way to dust myself off and get started over again, and I worked at a number of restaurants and dining operations, and eventually joined the Moosewood Group in 82. I moved back to the Ithaca area in 81, had a couple other cooking gigs, but joined the Moosewood Group and was active for almost 24 years. And I contributed to 5 of Moosewood's, I think number 15 is coming out next year.
The cookbook series.
Yeah. Well, those publishers say, here's some money, write a book.
Yeah. So That's right.
So for those who are doing that, who write the books, it's certainly a source of income, but it's inspiring and people are still interested in the restaurant.
When your life came unglued, did you go back to Brooklyn or back to...
No.
You stayed here. Yeah. And how did people come around you? How were you able to receive?
Well, my partner and I left the area. We went to Buffalo back in 1979, and she got a job, a good job at a place called Tift Farms. It was a nature center just south of Buffalo. You got the steel mills, the grain mills, all surrounding this incredible nature preserve where the birds and animals that, either thought, well, they're just incredible collection of animals. Yeah. So I lived in Buffalo, and basically the people there that I met, and I was cooking again. That was my livelihood. And then even got a job as a food service director at a nursing home in Buffalo. And I thought, well, all right, man, I'm really getting my feet on the ground here. But it was definitely not the kind of cooking I wanted to do, nor was it the kind of culture that I wanted to be involved with. I mean, you know, I was okay with the seven grades of food, everything from blended to full chew.
Yeah.
But I wasn't supposed to talk to the residents. The food we were serving them, there's more calories than a high school kid can burn off. And, you know, this is what the children of the parents who are residents wanted for their parents. They wanted everything from the appetizer to the chocolate cream pie at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were throwing away 80% of the food. I mean, people just didn't eat that.
It wasn't right.
That was like, I said, you know, this has got to change. And, of course, it wasn't. So, so I moved on, came back to Ithaca after my partner and I split up at that time, helped her move back to the Albany area. I moved back to Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
Started a number of things, and like I said, that's the point at which I joined Moosewood. And that was an up and down road, did a variety of things
What did you learn about yourself coming up, you know, pulling yourself together and coming back?
Well, you know, I guess feeling like I had enough skill sets and a variety of work that enabled me to find work. I was almost always, I mean, obviously being male and being white, you know, I mean, I got that privilege always, but you know, I had enough skill sets to continue doing it, and I loved working with food. I did some catering on and off when I lived in New York City as a student. I was a cab driver in New York for most of my student life, so I did some catering then and continued to cook, and obviously cooking at a sorority at Cornell, several restaurants, several institutions. I worked at the South Lansing Center for Girls for a brief time. It was a state position that provided challenges that said, okay, it's time for me to leave.
Yeah.
And then I started driving a cross-country tour bus and met new people. And somehow life began to take on the adventurous quality again, you know, after kind of like losing my moorings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, okay, the choices I'm making are working. I'm feeling good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, the occasional bouts of joy, you know, overtaken, depressed, bummed out moments. Yeah. So, it.
And you sound like you really do kind of live for a little bit of adventure, not too much, but you got it keeps you.
I like my days. To include some spontaneity. I mean, Gene and I. Went to Lake Ontario. We spent several days on the shore there. Great little house, great weather, but between the algae, which I learned was all the way from Niagara Falls up to Oswego along that southern shore of Lake Ontario.
Right.
Between the algae and the very, very slippery rocks, there was no beach essentially to walk on or to hang out on. I love taking a plunge into the ocean or the lake or the river, wherever it is water. I love swimming. I'd love jumping into Seneca Lake right now. So we didn't go into the lake. And then, you know, after a day of kind of reading, napping, eating, I said, you know, hey, you know, we're only 40-odd miles from Niagara Falls, which, you know, it's like, yeah, it's a seventh wonder of the world. But, you know, it's and anyway, we went to the American side, of course, which I hadn't done in decades. Usually I go to the Canadian side And we had a good time. We took the little tram. It was interesting watching people getting totally drenched under the American Falls. I walked along the cliff, and you know how the water sprays there. And we had some. You know, we ate out, and so it's just kind of like we certainly hadn't thought about going to Niagara Falls.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
So yeah, I guess at this age, you know, certainly the adventure has to be much more limited.
But it also has to be. I mean, you're not giving it up.
No.
And this, you said that you were surprised in some ways to make it to 68 and also surprised to make it with the level of comfort that you have.
Yeah. I mean, boy, I had no sense as a young man what kind of a future I was going to have. I mean,
what you had no sense did you have expectations?
Well, you know, it was like, you know, I mean, at 19, 20 years old, it's like, you know, I want the revolution now.
Right.
So what that meant, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, well, what kind of a revolution do I want?
Right.
You know, I mean, you know.
You want to be out from under your father and mother.
That was the first start.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and, you know, it's funny. I mean, my mom I loved dearly, and I would have gladly taken her into my home in her late years, but she died just before she was 73. Gina's mom, who's not just turned 94, lives with us.
Uh-huh.
She's been with us for a couple of years, more than 2 years now. And so, you know, my father I couldn't have lived with. I mean, I think I grew up with too much anger and resentment. We sort of made our peace, I think, by the time he died. But I could not have lived with him.
And you could not have lived his life is also what I'm hearing you.
For
a lot of us, our the lives we project are the lives we've witnessed our relatives and often our parents live.
Yeah. You know, I mean, when I think about changes, I mean, I can say that I've never hit a woman. I've certainly been a nasty word. I've definitely been a creep, uh-huh. You know, and like anyone with power, sometimes in my own insecurities, I would use it unwisely,
right.
or just for the sake of, you know, being a creep. But that's a lifelong kind of, mm-hmm. you know.
And learning how to calibrate your power and use it well is a lifelong
exactly.
challenge.
Exactly, yeah.
And we don't often focus on that as an issue.
Mm-hmm.
We'd do a lot better if we did.
And, you know, and now living in Interlaken, which I used to live in Spencer. I lived in Newfield.
Uh-huh.
I lived around Ithaca most of the 40-plus years I've been up here.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of immersed in kind of rural culture, and I understand the town-gown tensions. You know, I've worked at Cornell on and off for a variety of departments over. I worked for a total of about 18 years.
Hmm.
I was a sorority cook. I worked for the American Indian Program for a number of years doing a variety of things. Many of the years was working in Cornell libraries. I worked in the engineering library in the 80s, late 80s, and then recently, a little over a year ago, retired from Olin, Kroc, and Urs libraries, where I was there for almost 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
Great benefits, Cornell. You know, Cornell.
Right.
Cornell became, I think, a much, much better employer after UAW put out In the Shadow of the Tower a terrific video of how workers, full-time workers, had to go on food stamps and collect a variety of other social programs that the government provided.
And what year was that? What years were that?
Well, like we got to be talking in the, I'd say the UAW organizing drive, I believe, went on from roughly the mid to late 70s into the mid 80s.
Right.
You know, of course, you know, that video in UAW showed how compared to all the other Ivy Leagues,
right.
Cornell was like, you know, how can you treat your employees like this? I mean, just like today. I mean, when we think about how we subsidize Walmart and the other low-paying jobs. There was a lot of good stuff happening there at Cornell. And I enjoyed being there. I mean, there were certainly people there who were creeps and jerks, but it's a fantastic institution when you think about the amount of culture and thinking that goes on there.
But you're also working multiple jobs.
Yeah. I was cooking at Moosewood. I was working at the library back in the 80s. And then I left Moosewood for a while to organize the Cornell's and the American Indian Program's quincentenary program around Columbus's landing and what does it mean for Native peoples.
Right.
So that was, I felt honored to have that job. And I think part of it is that I think the people in the American Indian Program thought, "Wow, let's have an Italian head up this program," you know. And we even had the Sons of Italy come visit us, and because they were getting concerned about the anti-Columbus activity, not only at Cornell and in Ithaca, but all over the world, basically.
Right.
And so, but this guy. He was kind of a strange bird, an Italian-American, and I spoke to him in Italian briefly. He didn't understand a word I said, and so in a nutshell, I was kind of like, everyone else is being diplomatic. I said, well, what are the Sons of Italy bringing to the table here? I mean, are you offering a scholarship for Native students? What, you know, you want us to tone down the anti-Columbus stuff? You know, what? How are we going to deal with the real issues of what happened, you know, over history? And he offered nothing. And I almost kind of flipped out at this meeting with deans and professors and the folks at the Indian program, basically saying, "Tony, calm down. We'll talk this out." And you know, and I thought, "Geez, it's these guys are not getting it." And so, yeah, that was an important period in my life. I was working with Native peoples around New York State, especially, but I was the upstate New York Leonard Peltier coordinator for a number of years, and so Native struggles have always been a part of my view of the world, mm-hmm. you know. And when I think about sustainability, you know, and of course some people say, "Well, you know, do you ever see the dumps or what a reservation looks like? It looks like a dump." I said, "Well, yeah. You know, colonialism does terrible things to people, and you know, many Indians lost their consciousness just like the white folks and the black folks, and so now." Time to regain consciousness. And I have a signature. Unfortunately, I'm blanking on the name, but in a nutshell, a signature on my email is that it's time to fall in love with the earth again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Herndon. Anyway, I'm trying to remember the name of I'm quoted in my signature. And I think that's a big part of what it's about. And more recently, I mean, I've been I'm a part of We Are Seneca Lake. And I've been arrested a couple of times blockading Crestwood. I'm on the water commission of the village of Interlaken, and you know, we're upgrading the water system. And I'm still the project manager for Solar Seneca. Last year, we were part of the NYSERDA campaign to increase the number of residential and small business solar in South Seneca, the four towns of South Seneca, and. So right now we're working on possibly developing a community solar program, and I have to say, you know, the people in Covert initially, the town of Covert and the village of Interlaken, mm-hmm. initially mm-hmm. Gene and I have been living there 8 years in December, and we have a bed and breakfast, a stone's throw. If I might make that little pitch for my B&B. You know, at first it was like, oh, that famous chef is living in our town, and you know, small town kind of stuff. You know,
right? What I mean? Yeah.
And but I go to village meetings, I go to town meetings, and I don't say a whole lot. But you know, it's interesting how some of my progressive neighbors and friends are saying, "Why are you getting along so well with those town board guys? They're supporting your program." Apparently, we've got a number of conservatives on the town board and the village board who are supporting development of solar power.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And one Tea Party guy even took up my my petition cause to slow traffic down at the edge, right at my property. The speed limit goes from 30 to 55.
Right.
Which means about a quarter of a mile before they hit that sign or my house,
right.
They're accelerating.
Yeah.
So by the time they get to my house, they're already doing 55 or 60.
Right.
So anyway, this Jeff Van, the very conservative, supposedly Tea Party candidate, said, "I'm taking this cause up at the state. I think we need to slow traffic down, too." And so my progressive friends are saying, "Geez, you know, you're really chumming it up with these guys. They support your solar program. You know, they're slowing the traffic down." And, you know, I guess here I'm using my whiteness and my maleness and being a small business person to maybe cross some bridges or build some bridges that... you know, we've had difficulty with.
Yeah, and I think it's more in recent years we've had difficulty with, because this kind of relationships across differences, political differences, not differences of race or class, mm-hmm. Have been common for decades, centuries mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. country. You gotta make sure that even your enemies have what it takes to thrive in order for the community to function.
Well, you know, the Republicans on the ground, I think, are much saner than, you know, the morons, and I have to say morons, mm-hmm. at the federal level, starting with Trump and his running mate, and throughout the hierarchy of the Republican Party, just like the Democratic Party.
Sure.
I'm a member of the Green Party, so, of course, my Democratic friends in my neighborhood, you know, they get Gina's signature, and they get May's signature, but, you know, I'm not a Democrat, so I don't join on.
Right.
And so, you know, but at any rate, it's... you know, it's kind of interesting, because when I bump into some of these folks, the more conservative folks, you know, when they see, "Oh, it's Mr. Solar," kind of like mm-hmm. chum. You know, not that we're pals by any stretch, but you know, when Jeff Van comes to my house and buys a Sola Seneca yard sign, you know, I'm thinking, wow, this is nice. And it is, in especially in the sense that it's, I'm not so much the outsider. Because when you move to any of these small towns, like I said, I lived in Newfield and Spencer, you know, unless you've got seven generations buried, you know, you're always considered an outsider. You know, the local newspapers always have like those pictures of family members from like five or six or seven generations back.
Right. But I think for, in particular, for, because I worked in Spencer for a few years, and because we have such a flow of people that need to live in those communities to work in Tompkins County.
They're servicing Ithaca and Tompkins County.
That has all changed, and just in the last decade. Tremendously, in two decades for sure. Because there isn't that historic core there, because the people are just needing to live close enough that they can drive in. So let's cut to music. You said you wanted something from Joni Mitchell.
How about Big Taxi?
I've got it right here.
Paradise put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Ooh, bah, 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 bah. Ooh, bah, 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 bah.
They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. Charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? We paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Ooh, bah, 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 bah.
I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? We paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Ooh, bah, 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 bah.
We paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Ooh, bah, 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 bah.
We paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Tony Del Plato. Tony, how is it that you maintain your sense of integrity when you're working across these differences, and you've landed in a community,
right.
In a time in this country's history where we're polarized, maybe more so than any time prior to the Civil War in some ways?
I'm politically... In many ways, I'm very involved with people with whom are on the, more often than not, are on the other side of the street, the other side of the fence, the other side of the line, and yet...
In terms of ideology or party affiliation.
In terms of thinking, in terms of politics, what do we think about government or government's role in our lives? And so learning learning to listen and at some level respect the point of view of the opposition. What I mean by that, starting with a cousin of mine who's a Trump supporter. And, you know, for about a year now, I've been sending stuff to him, mostly cartoons. I know he doesn't like to read stuff.
Right.
So cartoons or short bits, short columns. And I think that in a similar way, there's a number of people on our village and town boards who I believe are Trump supporters. And find the areas where we can mix. But I think the big thing, even with the Trump supporters, they just had a a fountain welded at just a couple of days ago, and he's got a Trump yard sign. And I think we didn't get into it too much with the welder, but with my cousin and some of my neighbors, you know, it's like, I know my cousin wants to be heard, and I think most everybody wants to be heard, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of the hardest things when I think about it is like, you know, my cousin said some idiotic thing about how Trump's going to make the country better. You know, I said, listen, you moron. You know, the guy's a con artist. I mean, you're getting conned. You're not really, how can you not get it? You're not that, I didn't say it, but I want to say, you're not that dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he is, but.
Or maybe he's that desperate.
That desperate? Yeah. I mean, it's, I always acknowledge, I understand your frustration and anger with the Democrats and Republicans and the political process in general. Yeah, Trump's got it right. The system's rigged, but boy, he's not the solution. So I think learning to, okay, look, you know, these folks are my neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
I've got them convinced for the most part that, hey, solar power is a good thing. Let's support it, even though it comes from a state grant and there may be more grants down the line from the government. Let's use the money to benefit our community. After all, it is our money. It's our taxes. So why not, instead of supporting bombs and bullets, let's support solar programs. I think that for better or worse, I mean, it's like, this is the community I live in, so I've got to develop. If I want to be listened to, and I am at the meetings increasingly, I've got to be able to listen to them as well.
I think
that's probably one of the lessons. I've always thought myself as a good listener, partly because of my hearing loss. You know, I've got effort.
At least you have to be attentive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you said kind of respect, sort of. And what do you mean by that? Because, I mean, yeah, what do you mean by that?
Well, I guess in a nutshell, I say point blank, listen, I disagree with that.
Uh-huh.
And I give my point of view. And I know Joe, my cousin, especially kind of like, you know, he'll respond in kind. Mm-hmm. Said, well, you know, well, Tony, I disagree. Okay.
Yeah.
So at least we've got.
Well, I think you're a moron. I mean, some of these guys, you can throw the words back and it doesn't.
Well, Joey and I can call each other morons. Yeah. We'll probably still talk.
Yeah, yeah.
Though it stretches things sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, in small towns, you know, when something breaks in the relationship,
yeah.
And that's what really life is mostly about is relationships. What kind of relationships do you have with family, friends, neighbors, and all of the circles that revolve around us and. You know, and so in small towns, when something breaks, it tends to stay break, even amongst allies.
Right.
It's like
the hurt feelings don't get dealt with.
You know, some of my progressive friends, especially those who want to run for office, I want to tell them, you know, your skin's not thick enough. You know, you take it too hard when somebody, you know, either says something offensive or, you're not being treated right. You know, you've got to be able to come back.
Right.
Like, okay, someone hurt my feelings. All right. I'm never talking to that person again.
We still got to work together.
We still got to figure out. So go at it at another angle.
When you said respect, one of the things that I one of the things that I heard just come, because I come from rural Midwest. You're my equal. We can disagree about even the sun rising, but you're still my human equal. And I have to deal with you. You're a fact in my life, and that's we don't, there are, in this. I feel in this country at this time that is a level of respect that is missing, and it's part of why Black Lives Matters. It's part of why we have issues with undocumented workers, folks. We have this sense that at a certain point I don't have to take you seriously, and that is dangerous. That is really dangerous.
Yeah, it's. I did see during the hullabaloo, well, not hullabaloo, all the tizzy about the Confederate flag, especially after that, the murder of the folks and the black folks in their church by that, you know, I mean, obviously deranged individual. You know, just once I saw somebody with a pickup truck, big American flag, big Confederate flag, go flying through the village. Now, I'm sure if, you know, the village police were there, they would have pulled him over and given him a ticket. He was driving so fast. Loud muffler, actually no muffler probably. And it was just, you know, wow. I mean, this I'm living in the middle of this. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lots of that kind of sentiment in the rural areas. And my guess is that a lot of these folks, they all know one another because they've been there for generations, and yet they're very isolated.
Right.
They certainly have their comrades and friends and family, and a big family, of course, is a big part of their lives. But
And they're not monolithic. They stand with each other, but they don't necessarily stand for each other.
Yeah.
Want to switch questions. What do you do to restore yourself? Intellectually, emotionally, physically, what do you do, and when do you know you need to do it?
Well, how much time we got?
Well, we only have about 8 more minutes.
All right, I'll trim it down to about 4. I cook. I prepare food. I think about food. It's like food basically informs my day. It gives my day the structure. Not necessarily, I mean, you know, Gina will crack up at times that just as we're going to bed, I'm saying, boy, you know the strawberries we got yesterday. I think tomorrow for breakfast I'm going to have yogurt, strawberries, and we get wide awake. We got wide awake bread, a nice piece of wide awake toast, and either coffee or tea. Or, you know, I'm thinking about what we're going to go on a picnic, or what I'm, you know, in the morning I'll say, okay, so for dinner this is what I'm going to do, and even lunch, I'm a great leftover kind of eater, and so at any rate, I like making sure to. We put as little as possible into the compost. Cooking it provides a kind of structure, or eating perhaps, because I'm not always cooking. Yeah, provides a certain structure.
It's the gathering, the cooking, the eating, the disposing of whatever is left over.
I'm a gardener. I love especially this time of year. I mean, my garden is busting out. We need rain. We need rain real bad. A good 3-4 days soaking. Nice gentle rain. I read. I watch baseball. I wish I could play baseball, I socialize. I've got a group of buddies I've been playing poker with for over 30 years. I've got my comrades, and we are Seneca Lake, and we get together, you know, and that's always restorative, even though we're standing around sometimes for a few hours doing nothing but either talking to each other or chanting or just standing around.
Right.
The sheriff's almost always come.
Yeah.
And
some people strike up relationships with the sheriff's officers.
Yeah. You know, and I probably don't go to as much theater as I used to. I like theater. I love going swimming. Mm-hmm. You know, we just spent a few days Lake Ontario and unfortunately missed out there. But, you know, we'll be going to the beach in New Jersey in a few weeks. As a vacation, we shut down the B&B, and I'm going to be with friends and family on all of those occasions. I used to be an avid cyclist. I was an urban rat through most of my youth, especially after I sold my car and just went around Staten Island, Manhattan, and Brooklyn by bike. Biked a fair amount here until I moved up to Interlake, and I was mostly a commuter cyclist. I worked at Cornell. I lived at Common Land. And just, most of my life around Ithaca, I biked. When raising my son, I took him back ways to get from where we lived on the bottom of West Hill into downtown Ithaca. Yeah. And so we used to bike along the tracks and, you know, the back roads to avoid as much traffic as possible. Biking, I get on as much as I can now, but I guess the circumstances of my life right now don't let me. So I think in a nutshell, the relationships to the people in my life, Gina and May, who I live with, we have 2 cats, and then I've got my family and friends around me, all of whom throughout the week, you know, we reach out and touch and talk just for the hell of it.
It sounds like you've got a life. You've got a rich life.
I feel very fortunate, very privileged. You know, life's dealt me a few rough curveballs, but... But yeah, I'm still at the bat.
Yeah. And you're still smiling. You're still smiling. Tony, it's been a delight to get to know you.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah.
We're going to close with Aretha Franklin, "Someday We'll All Be Free," a 1992 recording. Do you want to say anything before I start it, or just let it speak for itself?
Let the song speak for itself. Aretha Franklin, for me, goes way back to Motown. And I love this song.
Here we go. Hey, on to the-
pain.